a woman wrote me a letter and she said, quote, "When I left your theater, I felt so proud that I'm a woman." And this is a theory that I have used all my life in show business. You must always set a woman up on the pedestal.
If ever a woman inhabited a pedestal, it's Ann Curio, whose name has been a synonym for stripper, or as they say at Harvard, ecdysiast, since puberty. Since 1962, when she brought her show This Is Burlesque to an off-Broadway audience, she's been a national monument. In Boston, where she's been living for so many years, there's a muted tradition that one cannot graduate from Harvard without presenting a ticket to an Ann Curio revelation. It's almost a prerequisite. Well, our Boston correspondent, Eleanor Stout, wondered how Ann Curio trained the young women who appeared in her production of This Is Burlesque. What was the secret of her trade?
My girls are fantastic dancers. They're all trained dancers. And if they had to, they could get out on the stage and they could really dance and do ballet, modern jazz, tap dancing and all. But we have to untrain them for our show because we are going back to an era when the chorus girls couldn't dance. And I'm constantly going to my girls, say, "Hey, come on, kids. You know, you're doing it too well now. Let's get the wrong steps in there. Let's everybody make a boo-boo once mm-hmm. now and then." And then in the lyrics also, they start all of a sudden starting to sound like a choral group singing, which they're not supposed to. They're supposed to sing off-key and make funny sounds and be nasal. And because they can do it very well, once in a while they get into that, because when they get on stage, because it happens to anyone, get on that stage, you're carried away, you say, "I must do the best I can out here." But I'm constantly telling them, you are actresses. You are not burlesque chorus girls. You are actresses portraying part of a burlesque chorus girl, and this is the way you must do it.
Do you let them work up their own act depending on their personality, or
not
is this something that you do?
Well, I have the chorus, I give the chorus girls a little leeway, because I think they should. And I psych them into what they're supposed to be doing out there on the stage. Like, you are the only one out there. You might be out there with 10 girls on that stage, but as far as you're concerned, it
is
you. You're the only one. And every man in that audience is looking at you, and you're going to flirt with him. You see him wink your eye at him and give him a little extra wiggle. You say, "Oh, you're cute. I'll see you after the show." And but with the strippers, I have to train them because they are not around today what we are doing. And they don't know it because they're too young. Mm. You know, they're 19 or 20 years old, my stripteasers.
Wasn't there a certain walk, though, that strippers had?
Yes.
Isn't that part of the usual
I'm
routine?
The only one, I think, that does it now. I do it in my act. They don't know it. You can't teach it to them. Well, I think Jennifer does. Jennifer Fox. Mm-hmm. Remember her, the lovely,
yep, the
gorgeous
blonde
in the second act?
Mm.
She does it.
She does the walk.
She's the closest thing to strippers in my era of anyone that I've seen since we were doing the show for 13 years.
And was there an identifying style that you had in the days of burlesque? Gypsy Rose Lee had her style. Is there an Ann Curio style?
Yeah, there was. It was by accident, though. I was the little girl next door who was too shy to take her clothes off, and all the men in the audience, especially the Harvard boys, they thought I was their sister.
I see, and that was the Ann
Curio
style.
And it was a protective sort of feeling they had. And women loved me because I was never a threat to their men.
Striptease is part of old burlesque, really.
How much?
Well, how often did the stripteasers come on? Were they just a small part of the show, or were they really a great portion of the show many years
you
ago?
You mean many years ago?
Yeah.
Oh, no, she only had her one spot in the show. The stripteasers were the stars. You came on, and your spot in the show, and you performed maybe 4 or 5 minutes, and that was it.
And American burlesque has certainly been around for a long time. When did it start? The late 1800s, maybe?
1868, when Lydia Thompson came over with her British blondes. And it wasn't until World War II, with the Lend-Lease Bill, that we were able to pay England back for this.
The black stocking girls. Tell us about some of the standard characters that are usually part of old burlesque, the
candy baggy
butcher.
Pants. Oh, the candy butcher, of course, which the very interesting story about that. But first we'll mention the baggy pants comic, who, to me, is the most important part of a burlesque show,
mm-hmm.
much more important than the strippers. Because without him, you're not going to have a burlesque show.
It's not burlesque, a funny show.
Burlesque comes from the Italian word, burlare, which means to make fun of, satirize, and you need the comics. And I baby my comics in my show because I know how important they are to me and to the show. The Candy Butcher was part of the show. He came out and hawked the boxes of candy. He made you all kinds of promises. You're going to get a watch and $50 bills. And, of course, you knew they weren't in. Of course, in those days, they were doing it for real. Now, we do it in our show now. But everybody in the audience knows that they're not going to get these prizes. And they buy those boxes like crazy. We sell them for 50 cents, and we do put prizes in them. And we're losing money. It's a gimmick part of the show. We also, in those boxes are, and we have pictures of the different strippers in there and the coins and all that, but there is a little leaflet, it's a little booklet that I wrote called How to Strip for Your Husband, and they try to get that. People buy 8 and 10 boxes until they find the one that has the pamphlet in it, and we put quite a few in. Every fifth box has a pamphlet in How to Strip for Your Husband.
Oh, I didn't know that. I would have bought one had I known. Certainly many famous personalities have come out of burlesque.
Oh, darling, we can go back to W.C. Fields.
Fields, Honey Bryce, Al Jolson.
Of course, Abbott Costello, Phil Silvers, Red Skelton, Red Buttons, Jackie Gleason. You could go on and on. Danny Thomas, Joan Crawford, Fanny Bryce, Sophie Tucker.
Did many people come out of vaudeville and go automatically into burlesque?
Not automatically. Because vaudeville died. It went into a decline several years ago. And the top performers in vaudeville, they transferred over, made the transition into burlesque. Those who could do it and were acceptable for it. We got a lot of good talent from vaudeville.
But what happened to burlesque? It's too bad that died. Or maybe it hasn't. Maybe you're discovering that in touring around the country with the show. People love it.
They love it. But we're the only one who know how to do it right. Nobody else does. Mm-hmm. Many have tried, and the public didn't accept it. What happened to burlesque is that it became very competitive. And the wrong people, the right people, as producers left, and the wrong people came in. And all they wanted was naked women on the stage, mm-hmm. and that's what happened.
With our interviewer Eleanor Stout in Boston. Let me point out to those who've observed that striptease panders to male sexism that just recently a startling number of clubs featured masculine striptease dancers. Let me also hastily point out I remain neutral on the matter, but you needn't be. Wax Roth, throw laurels, write to us here at NPR, 2025 M as in Mail Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., and we'll read every word. And while we're waiting, we'll hear from dueling banjoist Eric Weisberg, super movie star Jan Michael Vincent, Marta Casals Estoman, and John Lennon when Voices in the Wind returns in 30 seconds on NPR National Public Radio. I walked over and asked Eric Weisberg what his group Deliverance has been doing since Dueling Banjos.
Well, we're still recording. We have a contract with Epic, and we're working through Billy Sherrill out of Nashville. He's not really producing us, but he is more or less our mentor. And we're producing ourselves, and we're looking for another hit record, you know, basically. And it's not an easy thing to find.
He's producing you, or you're producing yourself, what does the word producing mean in the record industry?
Well, it means various things, as it does in as it does in movies and in probably any other industry. We have been selecting our own material, the material that we want to record or that we feel has a chance to make a good record or a hit. And we go in the studio and we make up the arrangement and we go in the studio and sit there and play it, and then we run into the control room and say, was it good or not, you know, and then we add the voices. In other words, we have total control of the recording, whereas an outside producer would be the one sitting in the control booth and possibly and saying, well, that wasn't so good, let's do another take, or maybe we should have a high voice singing in here and maybe a guitar lick in here or something like that. But we're doing all that ourselves.
Well, doesn't that keep you busy rushing from the control room into the studio, into the control room and back again, and worrying about what you'll put on this track and that track? Isn't it easier the other way?
It is easier if you have a producer who you can really work with well. Of course, if you do have to run in there and listen to every take or every other take that you think might have been good, then it does take twice as long. But on the other hand, a lot of times you eliminate some of the arguments, which also take time too. So I think it does take longer, and it is also difficult to be objective, totally objective. Of course, nobody's ever totally objective about anything, but we'd love Billy Sherrill to produce us, but he's so busy, you know, producing all the huge big stars that he does out of Nashville. Actually, he's told us that he thinks we're doing a fine job producing ourselves. But it's one of those things, you know, it's hard to figure everything out.
Now, when you start to work, of course, you have your own way of playing. You play a number of instruments, and so do the members of your group. What are you looking for on the record? What do you think the audience is looking for that you think you can supply?
Well, we have a good, solid country sound. It's not, we don't feel it's watered down with any other kind of real sound. I mean, it's there are elements of other things. There are, of course, Charlie Brown, who's a guitar player, is a fabulous rock and roll guitarist. So there are certain elements of it, but we try to really keep it a country sound. And we're looking for a song that people will like to listen to, you know, like Dueling Banjos was. I still haven't really figured that out, but that's what we're looking for, a good, you know, a real good song that takes the ear off anything else that's happening and puts it on the record.
Well, now, we're here in the studio, and you can hear musicians coming in and people going by and trucks outside in New York getting ready to record a commercial. But that's what you've been doing a lot of, acting as sideman or specialist in your own instruments on commercials and in bands and in groups. Just for an idea, what have you been doing the last few weeks? Could you name some of the jobs you've done?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we've done some interesting things. We did a few sides, well, not the whole band, but Charlie and I were involved in doing four sides with Johnny Cash and June Carter up here, which was really interesting because they were both very nervous and uptight about recording in New York with New York, quote, studio musicians. And we got into the studio, and we ran the tune down a couple of times, and Johnny just loved everything, and we were supposed to do two tunes, and he said, let's come back next week and do two more tunes, and it just worked out great.
Would you rather, for the sake of working, forget about the money, would you rather do all the interesting side musician jobs that you do, or would you rather go out as a band in the one-night setup?
Well, at this point, I think I would like to go on the road again. I mean, we really had a lot of fun playing on the road, and we all like being out there, but it's, you know, it's much easier to be out there when you have a hit record going for you and people know what you're supposed to be doing.
Hard-hearted, heartbreaker, dream stealer, love faker. Hard-hearted, heartbreaker, how many hearts have you broken today?
Hard-hearted, sung by Eric Weisberg at the helm of the Valiant band Deliverance. Other embattled sectors of the world of music include Brooks' Concerto for Two Pianos and Orchestra. For a Battlefield Report, we turn to Charles Christopher Mark, publisher of the Arts Reporting Service.
Dead is seldom buried in the world of music and the music business, and lost is always a matter of opinion. But then found is also a matter of opinion, and ownership is not necessarily 9/10 of the law. It all started nearly 75 years ago when the German composer Max Bruch heard a tuba playing a dirge and some children chanting a simple song. He tried unsuccessfully twice to transform this musical experience into a composition. Then America's first duo pianists, the Sutro Sisters of Baltimore, commissioned their friend Bruch to write a double concerto for them. And using the old experience which had haunted him for so long, he produced a concerto, which it is said made him very proud. In fact, He was so proud he arranged for the Berlin Philharmonic to give a reading of the work with the owners, the Sutro sisters, as soloists. This was back in 1915. Unfortunately, the Sutro sisters found the work too difficult, and they began to make changes in the piano parts. Mr. Bruck was justifiably upset and arranged for his friends to be uninvited to the Berlin Orchestra reading. Further, he extracted a promise from the sisters never to play the work in Europe in its simplified and unworthy form. The sisters brought the concerto back to this country, reworked the hard part some more, and actually gave two performances of it, one with the Philadelphia Orchestra under Stokowski and the other with the New York Philharmonic. Then, for some unknown reason, they stopped performing it and denied to all that the work had ever existed. It became lost. In 1971, the effects of the Sutro sisters were being auctioned, and a real estate man from Baltimore, where the sisters lived, bought a box of miscellaneous papers for $11. Right. The original manuscript was in the box. Since this man, Nathan Twining, was also a pianist, he was delighted and immediately made an alliance with a professional pianist, Martin Berkowski, to restore the concerto and play it. They hunted down other papers and notations that had been auctioned off, and with the help of the Westchester State College Orchestra, they managed to fit all the pieces together and recreate the original work. The lost has been found. Then the question occurred as to who was the owner of the concerto. Max Bruch had a son who was still living. He claimed the concerto as his rightful inheritance. Mr. Berkowski claimed the performance rights because he had done most of the restoration work for Mr. Twining. Mr. Twining claimed the work since he had bought it at auction and paid for much of the work leading to the piecing together of Bruch's original intent. About the only one who didn't claim rights to it was the second bass player of the Westchester State College Orchestra. The legal hassles have reached such proportions that publishers and orchestras are afraid to play the piece because of threatened lawsuits. Mr. Berkowski did obtain a copyright for Bruck's son just 12 days before the son died, after Mr. Twining refused to even show his father's manuscript to him. In case anyone is interested in hearing the music instead of the sound of egos and greed surrounding it, an angel recording has been made by the London Symphony with Antal Doraty conducting and with Mr. Twining and Mr. Berkowski playing the piano parts. This, of course, was done before they started feuding.
Charles Christopher Mark, publisher of the Arts Reporting Service, with an analysis of the theater of war in which Bruch's Concerto for Two Pianos and Orchestra is now playing. John Lennon, former Beatle, patron of the arts, is another sojourner in no man's land. He is at the moment to be found in such a battle station as New York City by such reporters as Bob Harris of the BBC, who asked John Lennon
the inevitable question.
Are they ever going to get back together?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, is there any possibility? But secondly, much more important, yeah. Do you think that it's a good idea?
Well, that's another point altogether, whether it'd be a good idea or not. You see, it's strange, because at one period when they were asking me, I was saying, no, never, what the hell, go back, no, not me. And then there came to a period when I thought, well, why not, if we felt like making a record or doing something. Everybody always envisages the stage show. To me, if we were together at studio again, you know, stage show, something else. If we've got something to say in a studio, okay. Now, when I'm saying that, I turn the paper and Georgie say, not me, right? It's never got to a position where each one of us have wanted to do it at the same time. I think over the period of being apart, we've all thought, oh, that wouldn't be bad, you know. I mean, I've worked with Ringo and George. I haven't worked with Paul because we had a more difficult time, but now we're pretty close, you know. So and the other question is, would it be worth it? You know, but that is answered by if we wanted to do it. If we wanted to do it, then it'd be worth it. If we got in a studio together and thought we turn each other on again, then it would be worth it. You know, and sod the critics. You know, I mean, you know, they've got nothing to do with it. You know, the music is the music. If we make a piece that we think was worthwhile, it goes out.
John Lennon still carrying that weight in New York with Bob Harris of the BBC.
I wouldn't change one experience I've ever had in my life, and a lot of them I found distasteful at the time, but looking back on them, they were an education. You know, everything is done for a reason. Everything is done to so that you understand something better or that you find out something about a situation, yourself or other people. And I wouldn't have changed one thing.
Jan Michael Vincent is halfway to superstardom, the natural goal of any blonde, rugged, handsome motion picture actor. His journey to the rarefied heights, inhabited mainly by Robert Redford and Paul Newman, has taken him from Bite the Bullet into Columbia Pictures' White Line Fever, in which saga of the hauling industry he has managed to keep on trucking. Jan Michael was born in Denver, raised on a ranch in California, and propelled into the unstable world of screen acting as the result of a chance encounter with James Dean's former agent, Dick Clayton. Our reporter, Tom Shales, asked Jan Michael Vincent if he was enjoying his new world.
My whole association with acting has been a great education. You know, what I value most out of it is what I've been able to learn from the time I started till now about myself, about other people, about the film business, about acting.
Do you look back on any one incident as a turning point that has brought you to where you are?
Well, there's several. I mean, it's like it goes in different plateaus and different stages, you know? I mean, you kind of go forwards and backwards. You putt along, you know? I think that maybe the first time that anything really snapped for me was when I did Tribes. It was a television movie. And it was a project that I believed in. I mean, it was really one of the first jobs that I'd gotten to do that I had some kind of feeling for the character and the project. And it got great recognition, and I think that put me up another plateau. The World's Greatest Athlete did a different kind of a thing for me. I mean, it brought me a different kind of recognition and with maybe a different audience and gave me the opportunity at least to go around and learn about what an actor does when he does publicity, when I'm doing right now, which was another education. That was another plateau. And then Buster and Billy was again a different plateau after that. You know, I mean, it was a different breakthrough for me.
Some people have said that Bite the Bullet could be the threshold to much bigger things for you. Is that a feeling you get, maybe from your agent or whoever?
This year has been a really exciting year, because I have been offered an awful lot of work. I mean, I think things may have gotten ahead of my knowledge even, almost. You know, I mean, I think that maybe more was happening for me than I even realized a few months ago. As far as Bite the Bullet and what it has to do with anything or White Line Fever, I who knows? I can't say. I just I feel like I'm finally starting to be able to understand my craft and be able to stretch myself and do a better job with the projects that I get, and that's really what I'm concerned with. I as far as what's going to push you over the edge at whatever stratus or position, I don't know. I don't understand any of that. I let somebody else worry about that.
Well, if you could have anything you want, what part would you like to be offered next? I mean, what's the part you most want to play? Or do you think about that sort of thing?
Well, you know, that's the most common question I'm asked. I don't think anybody's ever done an interview with me that they didn't ask that question, and that's probably the most impossible question to answer because of all the different factors involved in why you choose a project. The timing, what you've just finished, what you have ahead of you, who's doing the project, who's directing it, who else is going to act in it, who's releasing it, there's 9 million reasons why you take a project, and they might be different at different times. So it's really a tough one to answer.
How did you get this reputation, which has preceded you, as being rather difficult and standoffish? Is that totally undeserved?
No, I wouldn't say it's totally undeserved, because if I'm irritated by something, I'll say so. And I think maybe sometimes in the beginning, when I didn't understand exactly what was going on, I was put in a position where I had to deal with a lot of people I didn't know how to deal with, and I wasn't quite sure of where I was coming from, so it made it even more difficult. And I suppose that there was a time or two when I could have been difficult, but I think that, you know, that seems to be something that's said about anybody that's had any kind of success in this business, one way or another. I don't know of any actor that they haven't said one time or another that the guy is rebellious or difficult. Or, I mean, it seems to be kind of a standard label that's given to actors. And I think that, you know, that's one of the things that's almost encouraged in actors. They don't, you know, you're encouraged to be just a little bit different and to be more open and speak your mind and not be just like everybody else that you can see on the street.
One of the things that studios like to do is publicize people, and they are publicizing you as perhaps the next Paul Newman or the next Steve McQueen. When you hear something like that, how does it make you feel?
I take it with a grain of salt. I know where a lot of the statements come from. Either from, you know, I think the Paul Newman statements attributed to somebody who never saw one film I'd ever done. You know, it was only on a meeting, or either that had been made up by some PR person back at the studio. I mean, I really don't pay much attention to any of that.
Still, would it be nice to be the next Paul Newman? Is that something you'd?
Well, it would be nice to be able to have the control over what you do and the projects that you choose, and it would be really nice to have that kind of approval and recognition.
Like a lot of people, you seem to sort of, I don't mean to say stumbled into acting, but it was sort of, you just sort of happened onto acting and then you stayed with it. What might you have done? Where might you be now if circumstances had been different? I mean, can you see yourself doing anything else for a living?
Well, at this point, I could see myself doing almost anything that I felt I wanted to do for a living. I mean, the one thing that I've gained out of what I've learned as an actor is a lot of self-confidence. And I think once you have the self-confidence, then anything you choose, you can be a success at. I could really easily go into farming right now. I'd like that really a lot. I don't know what I might have been. Who knows? You know, I don't really try and look back.
Are you sensitive about telling your real age?
Not at all.
What is it?
I was 30 July 15th.
Was that a trauma for you, turning 30?
No, not at all.
Did you notice it?
No. I just noticed that I'm more content and more comfortable and more at ease in myself than I've ever been before in my life. I mean, I don't think that age, you know, physical years makes much difference. I think that it's just given me time to learn a lot.
Screen star Jan Michael Vincent, twinkling in our Washington studios with reporter Tom Shales. Three musicians heard in this fragment of Beethoven's Trio in B-flat major include two husbands of Marta Montañez, one the great cellist and humanitarian Pablo Casals, the other pianist Eugene Estoman. Violinist Alexander Schneider needn't concern us for the moment. In 1957, 80-year-old Pablo Casals married his student Marta Montañez, who was then 20. After his death at the age of 96, Marta turned for comfort to a man whose admiration for Casals had led him to proclaim, "This was the greatest man I met in my life." This year she became Marta Montañez Casals Estoman. In New York, our reporter Peter Gravina spoke with Mrs. Estoman of her new marriage and of her dedication to the work begun by Pablo Casals.
Mrs. Estoman, by asking you when and how your first meeting came with Maestro Casals, I believe it came after Eugene met him.
Yes, it was
what
after
What were the circumstances?
Well, actually, and oddly enough, it was at that Perpignan Festival in 1951 when I first came to Prague, to Prague and Perpignan, mm-hmm. to meet the maestro from Puerto Rico and to listen to the festival. Then, after meeting briefly with the maestro who received us so nicely because we came from Puerto Rico, his mother had been born in Puerto Rico, then I went back and came in 1954 to study with him as his pupil.
As a cellist?
As a cellist, yes.
You continue to play?
No, not anymore. But not since a long time.
But you studied a great many years.
Well, yes, since I was a child, and then I continued to study with him for 2 or 3 years more after we got married, and after that, then I just abandoned.
You had a great many other matters
to attend to.
This might not be an easy question to answer, but tell us, if you can, what was your very first impression the very first time you met Pablo Casals?
Well, I suppose the impression that many people have, one was in awe of this great man of whom one had heard so many things. On the other hand, he was so lovable and so kind when I met him that all these fears that one has vanished. So it was a delightful experience to meet him, actually, because he was so nice and so warm to us when we came the first time.
If you had to name one element, what would you say was the single most outstanding thing about Pablo Casals?
Well, I would say this human warmth.
His feeling for people?
Yes, I would say so. He had this attraction to people and this warmth that many people felt.
There is no question, Mrs. Stillman, that your marriage to Pablo Casals was unique. Perhaps one might say one of the most unique in the entire history of music involving a famous man. If the question isn't too personal, can you tell us something of the special nature of your friendship and the marriage itself?
With Maestro Casals. Well, it's something very difficult to explain, as you can imagine, but there was an understanding and there was a devotion, a mutual devotion that was, as you said, unique. These things cannot be explained, of course, and that's all I can say, really. You had to see it to really understand it.
Something you felt very deeply.
Yes, of course.
And which really needed very little talking about.
Right.
It's very difficult, if not impossible, to talk about Casals without reference to what he left us. I refer not only to the personal inspiration which he gave to so many and on so many different levels of life, but the festival which still bears his name and now will have perhaps an even greater significance. There isn't time, I'm afraid, for a detailed history, since you, Mrs. Stillman, are now president of the Casals Festival, I believe, perhaps you can tell us a little bit of what the present status is and perhaps what the future holds and in general what is happening musically in Puerto Rico as regards the festival.
Well, Casals founded the Casals Festival in 1957 in Puerto Rico, and shortly after that he founded the Puerto Rico Symphony Orchestra and the Conservatory of Music. So ever since then, all the musical activities have been related to the Casals Festival. We continue these festivals now, and we hope to continue them in the future. And now, with the help of Eugene, I hope that we will be able to carry on with this commitment that both he and I feel we have and we shall have in the future. Naturally, we have our own life to lead, and I am as dedicated to his life as I was to Casals, and both of us will take care of Casals' heritage. At the same time, he will continue his career, and I am dedicated to that right now.
Interviewer Peter Gravina. His subject, Marta Casals Stillman. The music, part of Mozart's piano concerto played by Eugene Stillman, orchestra conducted by Pablo Casals. May I again invite your comments, mailed if you wish to your local station, or to NPR, 2025 M as in Mail Street, Northwest, Washington. May I invite your proselytizing, tell your friends about us, and your continued goodwill. Write to your local newspaper. And we will continue to bring you this program, courtesy of all of you, with funds provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Your producer is Robert Monteagle, associate producer Robert Molesky, production assistant by Carolyn Jensen, the engineer Jim Anderson, and I'm Oscar Brand, another voice in the wind.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.